Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of August 3rd through 10th. This week we spoke with Dean William Michael Traynor, the Dean of Fordham Law School here in New York. Dean Traynor served in the Office of Legal Counsel for the President, and we talked about his time there and also some of the controversy surrounding that office because of the release of the torture memos in 2002. As you know, that issue is back in the news now, as there is some question as to whether there should be an investigation of government personnel who may have been involved in torture. Dean Traynor and I spoke from his office here at Lincoln Center. We began our conversation by talking about the origin and purpose of the Office of Legal Counsel.
When the Department of Justice was created in 1789, the Attorney General was assigned by statute the authority to issue opinions for the executive branch, so to issue legal opinions for the executive branch. In 1950, a separate office was set up that had the responsibility for issuing legal opinions, and that became the Office of Legal Counsel. So its primary responsibility is that it's essentially the court for the executive branch. It's responsible for looking at legal questions and resolving them in accordance with the best view of the law. It's not like a general counsel of a cabinet department who's much more in an advocacy position. Its job is to say what the law says, and that binds the executive branch.
Now, you served there from 1998 through 2001. Perhaps you can talk kind of in general terms about, you know, what kind of issues came before you in those years.
You know, there's a wide range of issues that came before the office. I think the most prominent ones might have been whether it was permissible for the president to bomb Kosovo, whether he had the statutory authority to bomb Kosovo, and whether he could be prosecuted after he had been impeached by the House and acquitted by the Senate. So those were probably the two most prominent questions that we had at the time. You know, my personal responsibility ran from questions involving the U.S. territories to questions of international law, national security law, criminal law. So very much the gamut.
Now, I think it's probably safe to say that maybe a lot of average Americans weren't aware of this office and what it did prior to, say, the George W. Bush administration. In what ways did the activities of that office change under his tenure?
Well, it's interesting. It's an office that before the Bush administration was really unknown to the general public. As a matter of fact, you know, when I was first asked to interview for the post, I really had no idea of what the Office of Legal Counsel did. It has historically been a central government agency because it has this great responsibility of determining what the executive can legally do. The people who've worked in the office have been, you know, some of the most prominent attorneys in the government. So Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia and Justice Alito, Attorney General Katzenbach, Attorney General Barr, were all people who worked in the office. So it had, it always had a great responsibility, but it was very much an office that had this mandate of resolving questions in accordance with the best view of the law. And so its opinions didn't attract that much attention until the Bush administration. It was always a very apolitical office. That was really one of its great strengths. It's what's made its opinions have the kind of authority that they had. But in the first years of the administration of President Bush, in the wake of 9/11, it issued a number of opinions that were much more advocacy, that reflected not the best view of the law, not the soundest view of the law, but seemed to have been written to justify desired actions. And that was a real break with what the office has done in Democratic administrations and Republican administrations alike.
The office came to national attention because of the release of the torture memo, which argued that federal statute criminalizing torture did not apply to the president's treatment of enemy combatants. Now, as your article says, in America, those memos were rescinded in 2002, I believe, but what is the status of other controversial decisions made by that office under the Bush administration?
Well, there were a number of opinions on the scope that took a very aggressive scope of presidential authority that were rescinded at the very end of the Bush administration. So it's not just the torture memo. The torture memo was really of a piece with a range of memos that took a broad range of presidential authority to, for example, use the military in the United States, fight terrorism, to have warrantless eavesdropping, really a broad range of opinions. A number of them were rescinded at the very end of the Bush administration. My guess is that there are others that are still being studied at this time.
As we discussed, the Office of Legal Counsel, probably unknown to a lot of Americans prior to this scandal. But now, do you think it's been tarnished, and do you think it kind of can recover its original purpose, which we discussed earlier, which is kind of being an objective, non-advocacy resource for the president?
I think it's very important that it does recover that moral authority as well as that legal authority. It's a critical part of the operations of the executive branch. It's possible that its authority will be restored, just as in the wake of Watergate, the moral authority of the presidency was restored. In order to do that, there are a range of different steps that have to be taken. A number of them are ones that I talk about in the essay that I wrote for America. For example, it's important that the office write an opinion that lays out its theory of executive power. There was one that Walter Dillinger, when he was Assistant Attorney General at the beginning of the Clinton administration, wrote that concerned separation of powers. I think another memo that focuses on executive power, and particularly in the foreign affairs and military area, would be incredibly important. When you have a memo like that, it is a reflective memo. It gives the office the opportunity to think in a careful way about what it should be authorizing and not authorizing. And then when it's made public, it gives other people the opportunity to react and to criticize. So I think that's very important. I think it's also very important to provide some mechanism by which Office of Legal Counsel opinions that authorize the president to engage in activities that reflect a broad conception of executive power, that those opinions are in some way, Congress has to be informed about them. So one of the things that I think was most problematic about the early Bush administration memos was that Congress didn't know about them. What you have to do is to come up with a mechanism for informing Congress without undermining national security, and that's that's a balance that really has to be carefully drawn. Dawn Johnson, who has been nominated to head the Office of Legal Counsel, has framed a proposal that has been embodied in a proposed statute that Senator Feingold has put forth. That's under consideration now. But the larger point is there has to be some way to keep Congress in the loop so that they know what the Office of Legal Counsel is authorizing. But it also has to be done in such a way so that national security is preserved. I think, and the final point is that the office has to be headed by someone who embraces the values that the Office of Legal Counsel was created to protect: respect for the rule of law, respect for separation of powers, respect for limited government.
Now, you mentioned Congress. What role can Congress play, and this is something you address in your essay, to limit the power of the executive branch?
A large part of what needs to be done is that Congress has to take its responsibilities seriously. So it's possible for us to talk about various types of legislation that Congress can enact to check presidential power. But what's really necessary is that Congress has to be serious about this. You know, in the wake of the Vietnam War, Congress passed the War Powers Resolution, which reflected a very expansive conception of congressional power. But that was really that was a high point in terms of congressional assertion of authority. Since then, it's really waned, and I think that there's always a concern that Congress, when they're confronted with a president who wants to do something that's politically popular, is not going to assert its constitutional authority. And so I think that's something that we really saw, in the wake of September 11th. You know, it's obviously very understandable that people thought that very strong measures were necessary to respond to terrorism. But it's also important for Congress, you know, to act, to preserve its role. Other framework legislation that's proposed. I think one of the most interesting ideas was proposed by Neil Katyal, who's now Deputy Solicitor General. And what Professor Katyal proposed was that the minority party in Congress have the ability to conduct investigations. And I think it's an interesting idea. I think it's worth thinking about. You know, part of what happened during much of the Bush administration is if you have one party in control, there's really nobody who's able to check and to look into what's going on. So Professor Katyal's proposal is that the minority party in Congress should be able to have investigative authority, and that there should be a statute that authorizes them to do that. And again, I think that that would be novel. I think it raises some questions as to whether that would have kind of counterproductive results. But I think it's definitely something that should be on the agenda in terms of thinking about, because it really is designed to address the question of how, when you have one party that controls both the two houses of Congress and the presidency, how you have somebody that has investigative authority to look into possible abuses.
Now, let's move to some of the events that are going on these days, and this story is changing rapidly, but the latest is that, there's obviously this movement. People are pushing for some sort of either truth commission or special prosecutor to investigate whether government personnel were involved in any kind of torture. Now, Attorney General Eric Holder there's been reports that he's considering putting a prosecutor in charge of an investigation. What could that kind of investigation look like, and how is that different from, say, appointing a special prosecutor?
Well, so there are a number of different ways in which historically the Department of Justice has proceeded when there are charges of executive abuse. One is to have an independent counsel. So in the wake of Watergate, Congress passed a statute authorizing the creation of an independent counsel to investigate executive branch wrongdoing. And so Lawrence Walsh, who I worked for, the Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor, and Judge Kenneth Starr, were both appointed pursuant to that statute. That statute has lapsed. So unless Congress were to reenact that statute, that kind of the pure independent prosecutor is not an option. Given that, the Attorney General has two options. One is to appoint someone who doesn't have the full statutory independence of the independent counsel, but would have regulatory independence. So, for example, Patrick Fitzgerald was appointed by the Attorney General. He was not a statutorily created independent counsel, but he was appointed by the Attorney General with various regulations designed to protect his independence. So that would be one option. And the other option would be to have somebody within the Department of Justice handle this investigation. So not to create a new office, but to give the responsibility to a line attorney, which is what we call somebody who's just a normal Department of Justice employee. If you look at the start of Watergate, initially the Watergate investigation was done by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. And a lot of people think that if the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia had been left alone, they would have uncovered the same wrongdoing that the Watergate Special Prosecutor did. So those are really the two options. You could create some form of special prosecutor and structure it so that he or she has independence to conduct the investigation, or you could give it to a line attorney in the department.
Now, the other recent news is that the news that the Office of the Vice President, Vice President Cheney, hid certain information from Congress regarding a program intended to apprehend members of al-Qaeda. Now, your article in America calls for greater transparency on the part of the executive branch. What mechanisms could be put in place to ensure that kind of transparency?
The one that I think is probably most effective is the one that I talked about before, which is for the Office of Legal Counsel to have some mechanism by which, you know, its opinions that interpret a statute under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, which is, for example, the torture memo did. The torture memo means, and then it gave a very limited definition of torture, and said, and if the torture statute is read more broadly, then that would be unconstitutional. So, you know, one important mechanism of transparency would be to have a mechanism by which Office of Legal Counsel decisions that use the doctrine of constitutional avoidance or that find a statute unconstitutional are in some way reported to Congress. I think that's probably the most important step. And, you know, I think, you know, above any kind of mechanism that could be put in place, the real critical point is that the executive branch, you know, embraces the idea of transparency. So, you know, more than any kind of statutory framework or regulatory framework, what's really necessary is for the executive branch to take seriously the idea that, you know, it should keep Congress in the loop, you know, with respect to, you know, its views of its constitutional power and to the kind of most critical activities that it's engaging in.
Just one final question. You mentioned earlier that a lot of these issues were a result of 9/11, the torture memo, the activities by the CIA, eavesdropping, etc. Now, you have said before at a lecture here at Fordham that one worrisome possibility is that we could possibly revert to that if the United States were attacked again. Are there certain legal measures that could be put in place to prevent a kind of a reversion to these tactics?
Well, the thing that I said at the beginning, which I think is very important, is that the Office of Legal Counsel have issued an opinion that reflects its view of the executive military powers and the executive role in foreign affairs and the congressional role in foreign affairs. Because one thing that is just very, very important is that we think about these things in times that are not times of crisis. You know, when you're dealing with a crisis, you know, there's a tremendous incentive, you know, to skirt the Constitution's requirements. And so it's very important that these issues be thought about in a time of relative tranquility. And then you're really much better positioned to evaluate them, you know, when a crisis occurs, because you've got a touchstone. So that's something that, you know, that I very much press for. But, you know, I think it's also important to recognize that, you know, in times of national security threats, you know, there's a tremendous push to try to narrow the Constitution's protections. And you know, I think it's important that we try to learn from our history, you know, that we think about the lessons of how we responded to 9/11, and that in the wake of that, you know, we think very carefully about what the proper role of the executive branch should be.
Okay, well, with that, we want to thank Dean William Traynor of Fordham University Law School for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you about this.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Look at our site this week for a review of the artist James Ensor by John M. Sweeney, as well as all archive articles on Pope Paul VI's encyclical Populorum Progressio. Reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to www.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.